Okay, so we're going to have a bit of a change of pace. We're going to go from the refined atmosphere of Caltech and Princeton to a somewhat more mundane situation, which is teaching medical students in a large state university. In this particular case, UCLA. So next talk will be by Julie Theriot, also about teaching of pre-medical students. So I'm one of the co-organizers of this conference, but at UCLA I have been involved since the early 90s in the organization of the physics curriculum for pre-medical students and life science students in general. So let me tell you a little bit about the situations or how that actually works. So I don't want to go over the whole undergraduate curriculum, but is this a pointer? I guess so, right? So the key is that when you enter UCLA, then as a life science student, you're going to ask first to fulfill your general science requirements. So the general science requirements at UCLA starts with as math with calculus, 3/4, for which the math department is responsible. Then the second year and sophomore year, they have to take 3/4 of physics with calculus, which they're supposed to have learned in the math department. Concurrently with physics, they take general chemistry for 3/4 and organic chemistry for 3/4. So that's followed by the life science requirements, which is divided up into four modules by now, which is biochemistry, molecular cell developmental biology, genetics, and physiology. It is a heavy course load. These people are not, you don't see them much on the street of Westwood. So a life science student goes through a fairly large course sequence. And this is also not, these classes are not taken for their enjoyment. Many of these students want to become medical doctors. And in order to get into the UCLA Medical School, which is one of the better medical school in the country, I think it is number 3 or something like that, you need to have an average of A- for these classes. Right? That doesn't mean that you can't be a medical doctor if you have a C, but then it's going to be the Fiji School of Medical School, I guess, or something like that. At any rate, these are all students who would like to go on at UCLA to become a medical doctor. So that's the background in which we're talking about the teaching of physics for these students. So this requirement, physics with calculus, has been in place since somewhere in the early 80s. And here is how it works. The students which come to us are from a very broad range of background. They're students from the state of California, most of them. Some of them are from community college. They don't go to Caltech and they don't go to Princeton, but they go to UCLA, and we are proud of that. These are people with a second chance. We also get students from Harvard Westlake, which is the top private school in the western part of the United States. So we're dealing with a very heterogeneous pool of students. 20% of them have never seen physics before. In the United States, it's quite possible to go on to become a pre-med student without having seen physics or even mathematics. Just, I do not know how advising works in American high schools, but the fact is that 20%, what?
Maybe 40.
I'm
not,
what?
I don't have any physics teachers. I don't think I take physics.
That might be a simple issue. There might not be any. There certainly are many schools where there is no physics teacher. 30 or 40% get algebra-based physics in high school, which is physics without any derivatives. And about 30 or 40% at UCLA have seen advanced placement classes with calculus. And those are the people we're going to have to teach. So they're characterized by a very broad range, and you are much slower and you have students much faster. And my experience is that if you lose more than 30% of your students, your class goes down the drain. So you have to be very cautious what rate you set for the students. You can't lose too many, you can't bore too many. If I compare the top 15% of our students, I would say they compare very well with physics and engineering major. There are some incredibly bright students among them, okay, who could ace physics classes. So that's the pool of students we see, very broad. UCLA is an affordable school. That's why many parents still send their kids there. Physics 6, that's the name of the class we teach. That's the required class which they have to take. And the physics department teaches 3/4 per year about 1,100 to 1,500 students. Okay? We're not talking here about 20 or 30 students for a biophysics major, right? We're talking here about something else. Typical class sizes, we're talking here about 200 to 300 students. Okay? Where you might have some TAs to help you. Right?
One or two.
Yeah, and you get some readers. So this is going to come back in the remainder of my talk. We have recitation session. I come to that in a moment. This is important, is the last physics they see. All right? After this, when they go into the life sciences, they are not going to see physics anymore. Whatever biophysics is to be learned by them has to be seen in this class. There's nothing after that. The life science curriculum is heavily loaded. You cannot simply ask them to add a biophysics class. It's, if anything, they would like to reduce the load. It's a service class. Now, if you're in a state university, the dean determines the size of your faculty. The dean looks how many classes, how many students you teach. So if you're like in the chemistry department of UCLA, you teach something like double that, you'll have a big faculty. Physics has a large faculty. If you don't teach large surface classes, your size of your department is small. In other words, teaching surface classes is bread and butter. Right? And this is by far the largest surface class for the physics department. So we don't teach this out of charity. It's because that's what we are paid to do. So there was a question about recitation. Here's the format. There are 3 contact hours per week, and there is a 1 hour of recitation where the 200 to 300 student class is broken up in groups of 40 or 50, which is run by individual teaching assistants. What they do there is they discuss homework problems and equation drill. So a significant amount of time in these classes is spent looking at equations, plugging in numbers, and seeing
they can process these numbers
to get the desired answer. Yes,
Rob. Is that ultimately aimed to doing well on the MCAT? And
absolutely.
That's a loaded thing, but
yeah. No. That's these kids have to pass the MCAT exam to become medical doctors. So the class must be relevant to the MCAT exam. Absolutely.
Because yeah, I think, well, we should talk about it later, but I just think that that's the most horrible part of this whole endeavor.
One thing you learn, Rob, is that you don't fight City Hall. You have to deal with life as it is. This is the situation. MCAT is there. This is the situation in which we teach students.
Yeah.
And I can't change that. So you have to accept it and you have to live with it. We teach physics 6 in 3/4. We're on a 4 basis. And in the standard format, which is what we were teaching in the 70s and the 80s, that 6A, that was when Phil was still there. Did you ever teach physics 6?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. So 6A was mechanics, 6B is electricity and magnetism, and 6C is wave optics and modern physics. Okay. And I don't have experience with other universities, but I should guess that this is a typical curriculum. The kind of physics we teach is all based on the Halliday-Resnick book. American undergraduate physics textbooks are clones of each other. They are all based on a book from the 1950s called Halliday and Resnick. You can trace problems from one to the other. And there are reasons which I can discuss with you privately why it is practically impossible to deviate from that. Typical books we use are called a survey. So it's a soft version, means that we lower the level of mathematics. Who is teaching it? This is taught by a mixture of letter faculty and soft money instructors. Most of the letter faculty who teach it are high energy physicists. These are people who would like to go off to CERN or to Fermilab and do their work. They want to get the teaching over, and they would like to teach maybe 2 of these sections at the same time to get all of the teaching requirement through for the year.
Okay? So that's the typical
letter faculty who teach it. We also have soft money instructors. These are people who are not very secure where they're going to be next year. There might be visitors. And they often get settled with large classes. Absolutely not. You heard that earlier on that thermodynamics and statistical physics is not too popular in the undergraduate curriculum. It's the same here. So thermodynamics is left to the chemists in UCLA. And the chemists do not do a very good job. Believe me. Sorry?
They just memorize formulas.
Yep. This formula member. So thermodynamics, which is a key discipline, is very poorly represented here. All right. So this is the standard format. Now, I've been teaching this class a couple of times in the early 90s, and in 1994, our dean, Roberto Pache, a high energy physicist, instituted a general reform of the science requirements. I want to remind you that the students, before they do the life science classes, take these general science classes. The life science faculty wasn't happy about them. They were dissatisfied about what the students were getting in the general science curriculum. They didn't feel it benefited them very much. But there was no consensus among the life scientists what they really wanted in these classes either. Except that they were not happy, and because there was course overload, there was talk about cutting it. I explained to you before that that would be very bad news for the chemistry and physics and math departments. We need these courses, all right? So there was this talk about cutting these general requirements, so Roberto Pache, who has a heart in the right place, said we have to stop that, we have to nip it in the bud, and we need a general reform. So he came to departments, maths, physics, and chemistry, and wanted from each of these departments a person who would be involved with reorganizing that. And then, since, you know, for the physics department, that was me. So that's the background of my involvement in that. I don't want to say it was a payoff, but I'd been pushing very hard for getting biological physics faculty being hired, and Roberto Pache decided to support that very strongly. So that was obviously something I couldn't say no to. So that's the situation. Biological physics would be, there would be, faculty would be hired in the physics department, but we ought to do a better job in teaching. So I try to sit down and ask myself, how do we want to organize it? Because although there was a committee of life science faculty who gave some input, there wasn't any consensus from them. So I try to ask myself, first of all, why should they have to take a physics class? What's the point of a life science student of taking a physics class? Is that requirement ever meaningful? When I asked my colleagues in the physics department, here's the answer I got. They said it's an essential part of scientific literacy. It's part of the of a scientific citizen. He has to be able to argue based on a rational scientific analysis of nature. That's the background. It's the foundation of natural science. Now, I may make it ridiculous, but it isn't ridiculous. In the life sciences, there's a person called Lewis Thomas. He wrote a book called The Lives of the Cell. And in it, he says that what you want from a medical doctor is a person who has a flexible mind. In the 19th century, they would have to learn Latin and Greek for that reason. Something really different, that would help them loosen their gray cells up. And he was quite serious about it. And I believe that physics could serve such a purpose. Mathematics could also serve such a purpose. It's a different place, it's a different world, and a medical doctor who learns to expect the unexpected might be a much better medical doctor than who just does have rote learning. The problem is, does physics 6 in that standard format serve the purpose? Particularly equation drill. If you want to think of physics as a foundation of the humanities, of scientific humanity, drilling people how to solve parabolic trajectory didn't seem to me the best approach to that. This point has been made earlier in this conference. Life science students practically never use an equation of physics in the remaining part of their life science curriculum at UCLA. Practically never. You can leave out the practically. Just never. Okay. There's not. I couldn't find a single equation in the standard in survey which they would use later on. What? Except for the MCATs, but if you look at the MCATs, they have been drifting more and more towards applications as well. But yes, If they would take molecular biology, they wouldn't be using it. They might use once the equation for radioactive decay when they would do radiotracers. Even as a medical doctor or a career life science professional, they wouldn't use any of this material. Of course, physics is heavily embedded in what you can call protocols. They use experimental equipment like NMR, X-ray, laser, ultrasound, where a medical doctor heavily relies on physics, but he typically doesn't know how the equipment works, nor does he particularly care necessarily. And for him, physics is basically operation procedure. It's just in some sort of manual. So if I, when I compared and I looked at the curriculum in the life sciences, my conclusion was that they certainly could drop Physics 6. Nobody would be impaired with it. Physics 6 could be dropped from the life science curriculum without negative impact on the rest. Yes?
But not without a huge negative impact on MCAT. I'm coming back to it because I want to understand the overarching logic.
Yep, certainly. I agree to that. So I wanted to formulate a different philosophy of why they should take it. And I try to be as practical as possible. I'm Dutch and I'm distrustful of any philosophy. My approach was, what happens after they take their physics classes? They have to take these life science classes. And could we imagine a physics education where the classes they get in physics will deepen their understanding of the subjects they get in the life science classes immediately afterwards? Because the point is that a class only has impact basically in the 3 or 4 or 5, 6 months at the ending of the class. Beyond that, forget about it. If this physics class is of any use, the only use can be in the life science class which comes after that. Okay? That was the basic philosophy. No more. Have a physics class which would be useful for a pre-medical student. And the simplest way would be take the Halliday Resnick curriculum and see whether you can update. And
can you
do it that way? So I took the books which you get in the life science curriculum at that time for physiology and animal anatomy. That was a book called Mariep. And I tried to see where there were concepts where physics could be useful. And there were many areas. The forces on the skeleton. That is how things move, the lever of your arms, of your legs, how do you move around. Physics of the senses, vision, hearing, and speech. Hydrostatics and hydrodynamics, blood pressure, blood circulation. Laplace law applied to the heart, swimming and flight. So there were lots and lots of biomechanics problems where physics would be extremely useful. Thermodynamics has been mentioned. Thermodynamics is a key discipline. Metabolism, thermoregulation, osmotic pressure are all very important in physiology and animal anatomy. Electricity, transport of nervous signals. So physics is in fact extremely useful for them because often they would be told about facts without the foundation, and that foundation was physics. So I felt that
okay, it wasn't so bad.
And I looked also, I made a slide before I knew you were here. So I looked at Albers and Stryer for biochemistry and molecular biology. And I asked, well, where could physics be useful there? Well, macromolecule interaction, the hydrophobic interaction, van der Waals interaction, electrophoresis, gel electrophoresis, how does it work? How does sedimentation work? X-ray crystallography and NMR, protein crystallography, energy transfer, thermodynamics of energy transfer, and again the membrane electrical potential. So in fact, if you take Albert's book, and you could very easily imagine a physics class which would give a better preparation so that when they read it, they understand the material better. So can that be based on the Halliday-Resnick curriculum? The curriculum we love, it defines us even more as physicists than Jackson. So the standard approach to that, that many schools try, is add problem sets and extra chapters. So you will find textbooks like Giancoli and Sorway who tried it. It doesn't work at all. The thing is that the Halliday-Resnick curriculum is overloaded already in time. You have practically no extra time at all. You've got to move on. It's like you're having a whip behind you. There are topic after topic. Any hope to add extra material in this train is hopeless. When you try, the material, extra material is always dropped. So, because we're always running out of time. That was one. nothing. And the other one, which is more fundamental, is called the wrong physics problem. And let me illustrate that with electrical transport. So electrical transport in the Halliday-Resnick curriculum starts as follows. You get the definition of the electromotive force, Ohm's law, resistance and equivalent resistance, Kirchhoff's law, and then we're back to drilling, which is what we love to do. We drill students to solve circuit diagrams, right? You get coupled equations, etc. So that's sort of it for electrical transport. The point is that the electrical circuits don't work in water. And in a cell, that's when, so when you're looking at electrical in cells, that's the key issue. So let's go through an undergraduate level of undergraduate level argument of electrical potentials and electrical transport in cell. Well, the key there is the chemical potential of the ion, not of the electron. Electronic transport is irrelevant. It is ion transport, and this is the key fundamental concept, the Gibbs free energy per particle, which consists of the electrical potential plus the chemical potential, well, this is the electrochemical potential, KBT times the natural logarithm of the concentration. So that's a fundamental concept. The second fundamental concept is that in thermal equilibrium, the second law of thermodynamics tells you that the chemical potential inside and outside has to be the same. That gives you the equilibrium voltage difference across the cell. And it is the same KBT over E times the logarithm of the concentration ratio, which Comdev already mentioned. And that's the universal voltage scale. So this is first fundamental principle, the chemical potential. The second fundamental principle is the second law of thermodynamics. The third one, that's the same Ohm's law we saw before. Now, if the voltage difference is different from the equilibrium chemical potential, current will flow proportional to the conductance. And the fourth one is that you have charge conservation. If you add all of the currents which go in and out through the membrane, because you have different concentrations inside and outside the cell, you can sum all of these currents, and under steady state condition, the cell is not able to charge itself indefinitely. This has to be zero. The net current has to be zero, and that makes a trivial equation for the unknown membrane voltage, and the unknown membrane voltage is the weighted sum of the equilibrium potentials and the conductance. Okay, so that's a four-line derivation. Now, the reason why I put it to you is that there is no way in which you can take the classical Halliday-Resnick curriculum of electrical transport and ask them for a problem set to do this. It's hopeless. You won't get there. It's just because the foundation is different for these two problems. Okay. So if you want to teach pre-medical students about electrical transport, you can teach either this or you can teach the other one or both. You can't really mix them. Okay. So can an undergraduate physics curriculum be constructed that does support a life science curriculum and is relevant undergraduate material even available? The answer is abundantly. Okay, I'll be really done. So is relevant graduate material available? Yes. So between 1996 and 1999, I wrote a series of lecture notes which were published by a custom publishing house. And lab reconstruction was funded by the dean, and we started with pilot classes with 50 to 100 students. The student response was very popular, and so the dean was impressed. They did better in their MCAT exams, so we also started with new labs. There were problems with them. And the dean then, I will not, since the matter, because I'm running out of time, I'm not going to tell you exactly how we reorganized it. This is the first section on mechanics, where we have much more emphasis on statics and of solids and liquids, hydrostatic, osmotic pressure, and only dynamics is towards the end. At any rate, from 1999 to 2001, we did full-scale implementation, and there were growing problems. Faculty members were not comfortable with the new material. Teaching assistants could not deal with problem sets involving new material. And I'm not talking about chemistry, hydrodynamics. A typical physics TA doesn't know hydrostatics and hydrodynamics. The faculty who were unhappy with the new material communicated a negative attitude to the TAs and to the soft money instructors. Faculty angst. And this is a quote from a colleague who wanted to make the thing work. Students asked me questions about photon absorption in the eye by retinal molecule, cis-trans isomerization. I'm teaching it, and they know more than me about the subject. Okay. The third one is what you can call the violation of the social contract. It's 11 p.m. at night. I have to prepare next day's class. I don't want to learn about membrane potentials. This is a large class which already takes a lot of my time. It's serious. These are big classes, 200 students. You have to supervise all of these TAs. So there were real limitations. But Jay suggested I write a teaching manual to assist the faculty. I went to Holland for a year. I was considering moving there. and while I was in the Netherlands, the faculty voted to return to the old format. I came back, and after negotiations, we decided the following compromise. The regular series and the honor series were split. So we said at physics, there were going to be two physics 6 classes. The old format, which would be taught by the regular faculty, and the new format. And the maximum class size for the new format would be 100 students, because we knew the pilot classes were working. And these would be the best students, who were very enthusiastic about it. In the meantime, we had expanded the biological physics faculty. Rather than me being the only person, there were now 5 faculty members, 3 experimentalists and 2 theorists. So suddenly we had the faculty to teach these classes and to teach appropriate physics for the life sciences. It also allowed us to start a biophysics major at UCLA, and we updated the Hayden McNeil notes, which have been published. At the same time, perhaps under stimulus of all of this, the regular series was revitalized. A very gifted colleague of mine, Katsushi Arisaka, who was an astrophysicist, reorganized it, and it's personality-driven, like Rob said. He is a gifted teacher. He runs student seminars on topics like special relativity, black holes, and supernovas, and the students like it. So the students who take the honor series are happy, and now the students who take the regular series are happy. We all get fairly high teaching ratings. I don't want to draw too many morals of it. Again, I'm against that too as a Dutchman, but here are the 4 conclusions about the story of UCLA. Teaching physics appropriate for a life science curriculum in a research-based institution requires faculty members with research programs in biophysics or biological physics. It can't be done by people who don't have a research interest in biology. Okay. The graduate students of these faculty members are the natural TAs of the class. It works. Our TAs who are teaching it, they know about the material and they're happy to teach it. We found that having a choice for life science students, we have a heterogeneous student population to have basic physics classes as well as called biological physics type classes seems to work. They can choose what fits them best. Finally, top-down teaching reforms, as we had at UCLA, may well run into faculty resistance. And that's all. Thank you. Rob.
I just have a personal remark as a parent of a kid at a UC school, and that is to say that that I always appreciate running into you for science reasons, but I very much appreciate all the effort that you put into this personally, and I think it's impressive as hell, and I'm sorry it didn't work out even better.
I think it actually worked out well. This sort of compromise situation isn't a bad idea at all.
Okay. What fraction of students take the 2 versions?
We get about 100 students. 100 students take the new series, the one I wrote with the, and I would say about 400 students take the old series. And that's limited by faculty size. We have 5 faculty members who can teach it. We can maintain the faculty body to teach indefinitely 100 student class. We cannot be responsible for a larger fraction. So it's been mentioned before, it is the bodies which are determining what you can do. Yes?
Does those 100 slots get filled up then?
Oh, we have to turn down students. I mean, the biological physics version which we teach is oversubscribed continuously. We get, everybody wants to get into it. It's an honors class and they get extra credits for that. So it's a very popular series. Who's going to teach it? Me and my 3 colleagues for increasing the class size from 100 to 300. It's just not practical to expand it.
Thank you very much.
should be spent on professional growth. And for somebody like Rob, clearly, you know, 60%. And for someone like Rob, it's clearly like 10%. And that's something that we just have to look at when we're trying to figure out things that are sustainable.
That's
probably a quick
problem. You quoted an interesting metric that was the students did better on the MCAT. So here's how you gathered that data, and how much better did they do?
So you mean for our pilot classes?
Yeah.
We trace them. We follow where, how we have people help us to trace how students did in their life science classes and then in the MCAT exams, and they get significantly better.
But this is comparing one student to which being a control or someone else.
That's a good question. It could be possible that these are pre-selected group students, but they were very pleased about the preparation they received for an MCAT. I should say the MCAT exams used to be really terrible, but they have been, they are getting better and better as far as I can see. We use MCAT exams for our problem sets, and they are more and more towards biological physics, I would say. They are more and more out in the life sciences.
Just as a comment, I mean, that was something that I noticed looking at the MCATs recently, is that I would actually argue that a lot of the times we actually are doing a bad job preparing them for the MCATs, because a lot of the questions tend to be of the qualitative nature, where they're given graphs, and we're supposed to actually read those graphs and make hypotheses, and not do the, what did you call it, sorry, formula?
Equation
drill. So in fact, I think our physics courses are behind the times. MCATs exams are ahead of the times. I mean, so.
I have no problem with the MCAT exam, and it forces people to think about how to set up hypotheses. It's not a bad exam.
Yep.